This is URN Sport.
Welcome to the Tuesday Sports Show.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for listening to the URN Sport on this Tuesday evening.
We will be discussing over the next hour all the sports news from the past week and previewing what's to come over the next 7 days.
Murray wins! Murray wins it all! This is going to be a tough play. Control this, and the cup is his. He's coming after him. He's immortal now. Usain's done it.
Here's Trump with three. Yes! A spectacular move by Michael Trump.
This is URN Sport.
Hello and welcome to this Tuesday Sports Show, the last Tuesday Sports Show of the year, but we are bringing it to you here. And coming up over the next hour, we will be discussing all the latest news from the worlds of cricket, rugby, tennis, and also a general discussion about a recent survey that's emerged about inequality between the payment of prize money that sports have been receiving. I'm your host, Jeremy Dunn, for the next hour, and I'm joined here in the studio by Jack Newman, Jamie Keane, and Chris Young. So we're going to start things off, guys, with a competition that has just come to an end, which is the ICC Champions Trophy that was taking place here in Britain. The surprise winners in the end were Pakistan. They beat the bookies' favourite India in the final quite convincingly by 180 runs, knocking India for six. Quite literally, they weren't expecting to be beaten by such convincing margin. England, of course, had lost to Pakistan on the way to the final and the semi-final. Another shock for them. They were India and England were the two expected teams to end up in the final, but Pakistan won, sometimes regarded as a bit of the anti-hero of the cricketing world. They aren't particularly liked, I think, by some teams, sometimes criticised for their negative play style that they have, but an interesting result for that. Like I said, a bit of an underdog story as well for Pakistan to win. But Jack, can I just go into you first on this? Like, what have really been like your thoughts? So first, we'll look at kind of like Pakistan's progress, and then we'll talk about kind of the tournament as a whole. But what do you think of Pakistan winning it this year?
I think it's absolutely phenomenal. You know, for someone of their stature going into the tournament, they were the lowest ranked side out of the eight sides competing, and to come out on top like they did is absolutely phenomenal. And against a side like India, you know, it's the old rivalry between Pakistan and India. There's always been that rivalry there, and of course I think 9 out of 10 people watching that game would have thought, actually, India are going to win this. They, you know, they are by far and away the best side. You know, they've got a lot of quality batsmen in that lineup, and you know, to win by 180 runs after setting a target of 338, which is, I think, the highest. It's the highest target that has ever been set at the Oval. You know, so to go out and do that, and India, quite frankly, just collapsed. Especially at the top of their order, you know, the main batsmen, you know, Rohit Sharma. Virat Kohli fell early as well. Yuvraj Singh went down very, very cheaply. And so did even, you know, one of their standout players, MS Dhoni. They were reduced to 76 for 6 inside of the first 17 overs. And from then on out, it was really seemed only to be one-way traffic.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, it's a quite phenomenal story, actually, the way that Pakistan managed to kind of defy all the odds. I think everyone kind of expected India to do a lot better, though. But it has to be said that the Pakistani, not just the batting, but the bowling, was just absolutely phenomenal that day. And one player that really does stand out is Mohammad Amir. You know, given his track record, obviously being involved with the infamous scandal where he was banned for 5 years. And you kind of forget, actually, just about why there was so much hype about this one player. And I think it really showed this in the Champions Trophy. He was just absolutely fantastic for Pakistan. And it was a bit of, you know, I think we all talk a little bit about England, but I think it's a shame for the boys to not have been able to make the final at the very least. But they were beaten by a fantastic Pakistan on the day, and I think given their performance in the final, Pakistan were rightly so champions.
Yeah, my prediction of Australia winning the whole thing 2 weeks ago just was blown completely out of the water when they didn't even make the final. But to stick with the Australia theme, to quote Ricky Ponting, looking at the stats, I don't know how we didn't win this. That's in reference to India, because three of the top four high-scoring batsmen were Indian in this, Dhawan topping the charts quite comfortably by about 25, 30 runs. But Pakistan proving in the end while their tactic of fast bowling worked, with Hassan and Junaid in the top five bowling figures for the tournament as a whole. But yeah, interesting. It's disappointing for England as well, obviously. They're not going to host this again anytime soon. And I don't know, it's sort of karma in a way, maybe, sticking with the Indian theme, because, you know, they didn't open up Lords for this tournament. They only actually had three venues, one of which was Cardiff. So yeah, it was disappointing that we didn't open up loads. I know we spoke about this 2 weeks ago, but you know, it just sort of dumbed down the tournament as a whole, which sort of maybe, you know, we didn't deserve to win it. We didn't take it as seriously as we could have done. But all credit to Pakistan, you know, Mohammad Amir as well. I can't think of a better comeback story. I know he's sort of an anti-hero, as we said before, but yeah. I can't think of a... who's been out for 5 years and come back, and he's just right back at the top of the international game as well. I think it's incredible.
I guess you could also argue, like, he should, you know, should he even be there to begin with? You know, obviously what he's done is very serious. So, but I think that's another debate for another time. But you're right, the way he's been out for 5 years, and suddenly he's not just, you know, middle, like, in terms of the world, he's already out there at the very top of the game already. It's quite a comeback, it really is.
Hello, this is Jonathan Agnew, and you're listening to URN Sports Show.
Yes, indeed, you are listening to URN Sport here on Tuesday, and we have already completed our chat about the cricket that has been going on here in the UK. Now, we were going to go on to a quick chat about the rugby, but we're going to just postpone that very shortly because we've got some breaking news coming in from Queen's at the moment. That is, Andy Murray has been knocked out of Queen's already very early on, and quite a shock exit for him. That's usually, we were saying when we just heard that literally less than a minute ago, that that's usually Andy Murray's guaranteed trophy that we've got there. I mean... Jack, you've been looking at this, just sort of, you were the one that broke this to us. Have you seen any sort of further updates coming out from this as to what might have happened? Do we know the score from what's caused this sudden upset?
Well, the score, as I'm looking at it, is 7-6 to Thompson in the seventh, winning that 7-4 tiebreak, and then Thompson winning 6-2. So it looked as if maybe Andy Murray was just a bit off of his game. I'm not really sure. I mean, this guy, Jordan Thompson, is from Australia and he's ranked number 90 in the world, which just seems bizarre. I mean, you know, in the lead up to Wimbledon as well, you'd think, okay, so he didn't have the most successful French Open. You know, we know he's not really that great on clay, but, you know, like you say, this is normally his sort of practice, his warm up into going into Wimbledon, and to be knocked out inside the first round is stunning, honestly. Like, I'm speechless. I have no words.
Can I be honest with you? I'm not surprised at all. It's just it's been a really poor year for Andy Murray. So, to be honest,
he is world number one still, Chris.
He is technically, like, somehow, literally, yeah, because
this
of
might,
like, technicality.
This might have knocked it quite badly. Yeah, he's got knocked out in the first round on the of second course. Day of
it's
Queens.
Unbelievable that. But yeah, sorry, you were going
to
say.
What will hurt Murray even more is that Jordan Thompson wasn't even supposed to be in the tournament.
No way.
He failed to qualify for it, and Aliash Bedinet injured himself, so at last minute he was pulled in to face Murray in the first round.
Jeez.
So how is Jordan Thompson, who mentally, well, 2 days ago, mentally was just on the beach and shouldn't have even been there and wasn't ready to compete at all, has turned it around.
I mean,
played the game of his life.
I've just seen the stats that have just come through from this from this match. I think you have as well, Jack. And, you know, just looking at you, for example, aces, Murray 4, Thompson 12 aces.
Incredible.
Double faults, Murray 3, Thompson 1. So clearly Murray was obviously, by the looks
outplayed.
Of this, losing his, well, outplayed and losing his cool as well. Certainly by the sound of it. Returned winners, Murray 0, Thompson 1. That's usually a strong point for Murray as well when we think about it. First service points. I mean, on every single one of these statistics that I'm running through here, just Murray is behind Thompson on all of them, apart from things like total unforced errors, in which he beats Thompson at 26-20. This is astonishing. And like Jamie just said, you know, this is a guy who a couple of days ago was not even meant to be playing, and has just come out and beaten the world number one on his home territory.
I think maybe mentally what could have happened is because he wasn't in any mindset of, oh, I'm going to give this all my all, you know. He was on the beach,
that's very
just chilling.
Possible, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe it's just like, oh, I've got nothing to lose, may as well give it a go. You know, it's Andy Murray. But the pressure on Andy Murray before Queens must be enormous, and I think the pressure builds even more.
Very interesting to see how Murray reacts to this now.
Yeah, I just think given his poor performances since being world number one, it seemed as though getting to world number one was the target. But the longevity of being able to sustain that position, someone like Federer, Nadal, Djokovic does very well. I think as well, given the injuries that he sustained trying to get there, I think it's massively cost Murray now, and I think he looks to be in a lot of trouble. But I'm not personally surprised, just given how poor his 2017's been.
I mean, I think we're going to try. I think he's going to try and reassure us by saying, "Well, now I've got more time to,
get prepared for Wimbledon." Yeah.
But there's no better way of preparing for Wimbledon than playing competitive matches at a tournament like Queen's on grass. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, it really is worrying going into Wimbledon. It's a really bad year to get Wimbledon tickets for me.
I finally got my hands on some. This could end very badly.
I mean, I think there's another stat that every time Murray has won Queens, he has then gone to win Wimbledon. So this is looking really. I mean, it could all be you know, false indication we're getting from this. I mean, we're immediately going to the British media thing and jump to Murray's kind of just notes of caution here. But the fact that he's been knocked out by the world number 90 is, like you've been saying, Chris, this would just cap off what has been a really disappointing year. He's got number one, but he has not been playing at all like the world number one.
Because I think even before the tournament, he was not made favourite at all, was he? I think, you know, Federer's, I think, it now expected to win another Wimbledon title, which is unbelievable. But yeah, and I think it's just staggering, really. I think it just kind of just shows the, like, over such a short period of time as well, just how Andy Murray, from like December winning that world number one title, and suddenly it looks as though he's going to lose it. I can't imagine him holding on to it for much longer, the world number one, because, like, he's been knocked out of the early rounds of both Opens already. Wimbledon, though, is more of his ground. That's more of his, like, territory, and he's won it twice. He's the reigning champion, of course. But maybe it is a case of we're being too harsh on him. But I think, given the recent results, I think fans do have a right to actually be quite anxious, that's got to be said.
Hi, I'm Stuart Pearson. You're listening to URN.
Welcome back to URN Sport for this, the Tuesday Sports Show, the last Tuesday Sports Show, of course, of the year. We've done our run through of everything that's been going on from the cricket and also the breaking news that's been coming out of today's action at Queen's. But now we're going to go back across to the far side of the world to see how things have been going on for the British and Irish Lions. They have had their last game before they will be taking on New Zealand in their first actual proper test match, which will be going on. They came out triumphant against Chiefs. It was a good win for them. They've been needing this sort of a win. It was a 6-34 win for them, which has been needed, especially with some of the questions hanging over with some of the injuries they've been picking up. Obviously, Stuart Hogg has now been confirmed to have been ruled out. On last week's show, we weren't sure because we had unconfirmed reports as to how bad the extent of his injury was, but Hogg has been sent home, which is a major blow, some would say, for the progress. Some would say it gives others the opportunity. But first, let's talk about the game for the Lions against Chiefs before we then move on to preview their first test match against New Zealand. So, Chris, I want to get your thoughts on this. I mean, when you look at the scoreline, it's a good result for them, and they have needed this kind of big win. I mean, they beat Crusaders, and when we were talking about them last week, Crusaders are the rugby world's equivalent of, you'd say, a Real Madrid. They are the pinnacle when it comes to rugby union club level. But they haven't ever, whilst they've been down there, won with a big, convincing score, and they have now, and just before the first test. Is that the major psychological boost they've been wanting?
I think it does give them a massive boost in terms of confidence, that's definitely for sure, but I do feel as though, ultimately, there's so much that things like confidence could do against a team like New Zealand, who are by far the best rugby team in the universe, in my opinion. Like, it's just phenomenal. It is really good to see players do really well against the Chiefs. So you've got Jack Nowell, who's had a lot of doubt over why he's there to begin with. People think he's a bit too lightweight, but got two tries, which was great news for him. And also someone like Dan Bigger, again, questions over, you know, is he good enough to be there with the Lions, but had a really good solid performance. But no, it's a massive confidence boost, and I think it also shows just how much strength and depth there actually is in this Lions squad, the fact they actually beat the Chiefs quite convincingly. So they've got the three tests against New Zealand coming up now. They've also got one other exhibition match against the Highlanders, who are known for their nice flair attacking rugby. But I think what does seem to be the case is, and I don't think it's actually really affected the changing rooms necessarily, but of course there's been a lot of talk as to Warren Gatlin seeming to favour Welsh players over people from over people from Scotland, over people from England or from Ireland. So you think of all the four people that Warren Gatlin's taken, when you've got England and Argentina, who've been brilliant against them despite losing so many of their players. Scotland beating Australia is a phenomenal result, and it's good to see someone like Finn Russell actually get a call up. It's very well deserved. So you just kind of, it does beg the question, why aren't more of those guys being taken, and why are uncapped Welsh players effectively being taken to the Lions squad? Warren Gatland says it's for convenience, but there does seem to be a hint of bias, it's got to be said.
Yeah, it's something I brought up 2 weeks ago, that the whole Lions concept is such a difficult one. It's something that really confused me. I'm very pessimistic, particularly about this Lions tour. That win against the Chiefs, I don't think we should really take into account that much. They were missing 11 players in total. 6 were actually All Blacks, including Damian McKenzie, Aaron Cruden and Brody Retallick. So, you know, their core team was gone there. A main talk point from the game I've looked at was the actual referee, Jerome Garces, who was in favour of sort of Warren Gatland's thought process behind blocking. A lot of referees don't give many blocks, but in the first half, two blocks were given in favour to the Lions, which resulted in tries as well. So it's fine margins. I know we won by, you know, what was it, 30 points in the
34-6,
end. 34-6,
yeah.
34-6. So, you know, two tries maybe don't make much of a difference, but in general, I want to talk about Lions this year. The captaincy hasn't been decided, and how far away are we from placing the Oblast? Not long at all. I was looking at an article before, and the captain we were supposed to take into the tournament to be our leader, Sam Warburton, is actually struggling to get in the team. He's on the fringe of the British Irish Lions squad, and he's supposed to be the captain. It's very worrying going into the All Blacks. I think we're going to get smashed in our first game, and I think the final two games after that are recovery from that, and you know, maybe we can win the last one.
Yeah, no, I sadly kind of have to echo a lot of what Jamie said. I just think the form that New Zealand go into this tournament as well, beating Samoa, but by a score of 78-0 is just unbelievable. Yeah. And you just think of just how attacking and like how quick their rugby is. It's quite phenomenal. And I think this England squad, given the fact that maybe in the in the changing rooms, it doesn't seem to be divided, but I think on the pitch, it just doesn't seem to be much of like a game plan. We don't seem to have a clear starting 15, and you're right, there doesn't seem to be leadership on the pitch in terms of like Warburton. It looks as though Peter O'Malley, O'Maloney, that's the one, sorry, yeah, is set to become the captain for the first test. Again, that's just rumours though, but given the form that New Zealand is going into this test, it does look as though we are going to get thumped, given the fact that we have played, was it 5 games already, and we've lost 2 of them, which doesn't bode well.
Hi, I'm Lauren Herrier, your SU Sports Officer, and you're listening to URN Sport.
Welcome back to URN Sport for this Tuesday Sports Show, and we are now into the final 10 minutes of the Tuesday Sports Show for this year, but we're going to wrap it up with the latest news that's been coming out from BBC Sports this week, which was a survey they conducted to see how much there is in terms of disparity and inequality in Olympic sports for athletes, and in terms of how much they win in terms of prize money. Now, they said that in 2014, it was reported that 30% of all sports, all Olympic grade sports, have an inequality in the pay for the prize money that the athletes will get. Now, by this year, 2017, that has now gone down 17%. So we have seen improvement in it, but it clearly is there. You know, this division in sort of wealth and funding of how much athletes get, both in terms of for funding their actual what they're doing, and also in terms of the rewards they get prize money wise, is very different. One interesting thing which really caught my eye from this survey is that squash, apparently, the inequality within squash has apparently been ceased since the two governing bodies, the men's and the women's, merged to create a single one. And that has now seen that both men and women are getting paid equally in squash. This is obviously Team GB related we're talking about here. We can't obviously say for all of them, but in Team GB wise. Now, considering that their funding comes from the National Lottery Fund as well, it is really rather surprising that there is this disparity between the two. And it's only when a sport itself takes its own initiative, like we've seen there with squash, that they merged the two bodies together to create equal pay. To create one body that we actually then get this equal pay. Why is it, do we guys think, that we still have this thing going on in place? I mean, it's one which it does divide opinion quite a lot, but it's something which is obviously on the down. But a lot of people are saying that it's still a major pressing issue.
Since we said we were going to break the story, the only reason I can think of is possibly ticket sales. I think for some sports, not a lot, but some sports, Olympic sports, there seems to be more tickets sold for men's events than women's events. So I'm talking about the men's 100 metre final. There would definitely be more people in the stadium at the time of that being on than the women's, which is also shown at an earlier time of day as well. It's
I think so, yeah.
It's a sort of harder event to get to if you've got work and things. So that's literally the one thing I can think of. Also, maybe sponsorships could come into it as well.
But apart from that,
just ticket sales, that's the only thing, because there seems to be a lot more people at men's events than women's events.
I think it is interesting, actually. It's maybe not to talk about the big sports for now, you know, things like maybe like basketball, football, where there is a massive, massive, massive pay difference. But I think as well, the Olympic sports that we talk about, maybe sports like taekwondo, badminton, squash, those events don't tend to be quite well attended, it's got to be said. So maybe like good attendance, but quite like moderate compared to like, you know, the hunt, like the many thousands you get at a football game. But I think it is just what really interesting, actually, because at Olympics, especially when you look at maybe like something like London, effectively all those events were sold out, you know, regardless of gender. So there definitely is popularity across both sides of, you know, male and female sports. So in terms of why there isn't necessarily equal pay, maybe ticket sales outside of the Olympics, but certainly in the Olympics, I feel, or like big events like the World Athletics events, the World Athletic Championships is coming up in July, so I think that could give us a better indication, a quite good indication as well, as to how much things like attendance has actually shrunken between people going to men's events, people going to women's events. I'm not entirely sure, but it does seem to be as though for the smaller sports, there doesn't seem to be much of a difference between attendance between male and female sports, so I don't quite understand why there is such a big divide in pay.
I feel like, you know, going back to a point that Jamie said as well, sponsorship is a massive deal with it, you know. But you talk about sports that are not included in the Olympics and sports outside, you know, you talk about football and stuff. The male players very much see it as, you know, they're trying to sell themselves to the media, they're trying to get as much publicity as they can. Well, I think, you know, it's not a detriment to the women that they want to keep themselves to themselves, you know. I think that that's highly respectful, that you don't want to be involved with publicity that much. But I feel like, yeah, there is, just in terms of men's, you know, they have that ego and they feel like, you know, I need to market myself as a brand, I need to get myself out there. You know, we've seen it done with the likes of David Beckham, Messi, Ronaldo, all of the top players want to market themselves, they want to bring in the high sponsorship deals, and, you know, these companies will go ahead and do it. And I feel like maybe perhaps the women's, they're not marketing themselves as much. But like I say, it's really, I feel like it's not a detriment to say that. I feel like it's very respectful that they don't want to perhaps get involved as much with that side of the sport, with that sort of whole media aspect to it. So I feel like in terms of sponsorships, it's very much men go out there and try to, you know, get as much money as they can, whereas women's very much keep themselves to themselves and aren't really too bothered about any kind of sponsorship deals or money that comes in. Obviously, it's a bonus when it does happen, but they won't go out of their way to try and market themselves to big name companies.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting when we're talking about this, and just kind of then on a closing point, the whole closing point for the show for this academic year, actually. But just Wimbledon didn't have this sort of, in terms of prize money, which the winners would get. You know, there was this, they had a disparity of it until 2007, whilst the US Open, for example, had actually addressed this several years previously. And another just sort of on other sports, you know, we're looking outside of the Olympics at the moment here, but other sports like cricket, they've said that they aim to have kind of equal pay for prize money for teams to be achieved within 15 years. Now, for those ones that are outside of a central major governing body for one nation, that is understandable. I probably would think that we agree on that it's just sort of, you know, for a long time period. Yeah. But just very quickly, when it's sort of, you know, an individual tournament like, for example, tennis, wrapping it just back up then to that finally, when, you know, they've got the stars for it. I mean, we talked about star pulling power, but when you've got the stars like the Williams sisters, for example, and when she was, obviously, before she got disgraced, obviously, Sharapova as well throwing in there, why did it take them so long, do you reckon, for that to then happen, for them to actually get the final equality on pay for that? Just as a final thought.
I think that, you know, is part of like a whole wider culture, and so we haven't really got time for that. But I think people are starting to recognise that as many people are going to watch the women's games in Wimbledon as they are the men's game. I think, you know, tennis is very well attended in both male and female matches. So I think that's why, because women have actually now got a genuine argument being, well, actually, look at all the fans we're able to bring in as well. So I think that's why they've helped to shorten the gap.
Yeah, I think it's definitely it's a complicated issue. I don't think it's as simple as we want it to be. I don't think it's there's one person saying no, I don't want women to be paid. It's definitely a lot more. I think it probably goes into how much money certain players make for the governing body, etc., like that, and if there's a disproportionate amount of men and women in that status. I'm not sure, but it's good to see that it's on the rise, and big sports like tennis have now become equal.
Yeah, well, there we are. That's going to be then the point that we wrap up this year's Tuesday Sports Show on. I'd like to say a massive thanks to Jack, Jamie, and also Chris for coming on here, and also a massive thanks to everyone that's been on the show throughout the entirety of the year.
This is URN Sport.